From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will Kobe give L.A. fans the beef, or will Boston fans ride the big ticket to a 17th NBA title? And will the championship be overshadowed by a growing referee scandal? Ahead on Only a Game, Kevin Hench answers those questions. Also, a preview of next week's U.S. gymnastics trials and a conversation with Jennifer Say, author of Chalked Up, Inside Elite Gymnastics, Merciless Coaching, Overzealous Parents, Eating Disorders, and Elusive Olympic Dreams. Also ahead, funny car driver John Force was almost unbeatable until his daughter followed him onto the drag strip.
It's fun to race him, and to be able to beat him, you know, he's a tough competitor. He's won a lot of championships, a lot of races, but he's also taught us, so we've had the best teacher out here to learn from.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. A Tuesday court filing by the attorney of ex-NBA referee Tim Donaghy alleges that the NBA manipulated its referees during the 2002 and 2005 playoffs in order to boost ticket sales and television ratings. Those manipulations, according to what Donaghy told federal law enforcement officials, included the failure to assess technical fouls to star players and allowing team owners to influence the way certain fouls were called. Since Tuesday, many observers, paranoid and otherwise, have been shouting, "I told you so!" While Commissioner Stern has extinguished several brush fires, if not the current controversy, with his dismissive hand gestures. Here to discuss the growing controversy and its effect on the 2008 NBA Finals is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good morning, Bill.
Donaghy alleges that Game 6 of the 2002 Western Conference Finals between Sacramento and Los Angeles, which went on to win that championship that year, was rigged to ensure there would be a Game 7. We've heard conspiracy theories for years. Is there anything to this allegation?
I don't think so, and I don't know if that's just hoping and wishful thinking on my part, but the more I've thought about it, the more obvious it seems that Donaghy has chosen two famous incidents to kind of glom onto where the public story is known, so he knows he'll get a lot of agreement from the conspiracy theorists. What would have been more compelling for me is if he told us about a game we barely remembered. I think choosing those two events sort of undermines his already shaky credibility on the issue.
Since that court filing, it's been learned that the NBA has been asking referees about veteran referee Dick Bavetta and his calls in that Game 6 of the 2002 Western Conference Finals. Did you see that game, and if so, what was your take on the officiating?
I did see that game, and I think Dick Bavetta had a bad game. So did his partners, Ted Bernhardt and Bob Delaney. That is not the same thing as corruption or game fixing. And I feel like if to point to a couple of games out of the hundreds of games that have taken place that Dick Bavetta has done that have taken place over the last 10 years is not really compelling evidence that there's some league-wide corruption going on. The other evidence that there's not league-wide corruption going on is that the Spurs kept making it to the finals and winning championships, and last year they dispatched LeBron James in four games. If there is a conspiracy, it's a poorly executed one, to say the least.
The letter also claims that the owner of Team 3, who is quite obviously Mark Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks, complained about the lack of illegal screens called on the Rockets center Yao Ming during games 1 and 2 of the opening round of the 2005 playoffs. Even if Cuban's complaints did, as Donaghy claims, influence how the referees made their foul calls in subsequent games, was it wrong for Cuban, or would it be wrong for anybody, for that matter, to insist that existing rules should be enforced?
Not at all. And in fact, if Cuban's complaints dovetailed with what the league itself was seeing when it reviewed game tapes of game 1 and 2, it would be perfectly within their rights to say, "Hey guys, we need to call illegal screens. Yao Ming is moving his feet. Yao Ming is leaning his shoulder in." And that's another example of where this conspiracy theory kind of gets blown up, because the league in its ever globalizing mode doesn't want Yao Ming knocked out of the playoffs and taking his 1.3 billion fans with him. I mean, this is insane that the league would have a vested interest in getting Yao Ming out of the playoffs.
up until his Thursday night press conference, NBA Commissioner David Stern's responses to Dunahee's charges dwelled on Dunahee's motives as a convicted felon desperate to avoid jail time. On Thursday, the commissioner went beyond that, strongly asserting that his officials did not do anything illegal. Do you think that Stern has done all he can do to respond to these charges and restore the public's faith in the integrity of the NBA?
Well, the one thing he has not done that I think he could do that he might want to consider at this point is actually just admitting that his referees are not competent enough to fix a game. I think this would assuage a lot of concerns.
Do you think the NBA's biggest problem right now, as some people have claimed, is simply one of perception?
Absolutely. The game has become almost impossible to officiate. The guys are so big, so fast, it's so physical that you're going to be given 100 of those instantaneous 50-50 block charge calls, and if you call them evenly between the two teams, nobody's going to squawk about it. But on those nights in the playoffs, like Game 2 of the NBA Finals, where if one team gets most of the 50-50 calls, Phil Jackson's going to go to the podium, and he's going to fan the flames of those conspiracy theorists. It's a bad perception for the league that something is amiss, but that doesn't mean that something is amiss.
Let's shift gears and talk a little about some actual basketball. Game 4 on Thursday gave us that improbable comeback by the Celtics. They now have a 3-1 lead over the Lakers. Have you been surprised at how hot and cold each team has been during this series?
Well, I think Phil Jackson said it best after the third quarter of Game 4 when he told Michelle Tafoya, "Momentum is a strange girl." And right now, she's behaving like Amy Winehouse. She's going to have to go into rehab. The momentum girl has been so out of control. From the end of the third quarter of Game 2 until midway through the third quarter of Game 4, the Celtics were outscored by 46 points by the Lakers. How you only lose one game being outscored by 46 points over 7.5 quarters is a mystery to me. But obviously, the Celtics, with that crazy run on Thursday night, have put a hammer lock on the series.
Given the current circumstances, Kevin, are you sticking with your prediction last week that the Lakers will win it all, or will Los Angeles throw in the purple and gold towel?
I'm sticking with my prediction, Lakers in 5.
I love it.
That's how certain I am.
And only a game prediction if there ever was one.
What an idiot.
Kevin Hinch covers a panoply of games for FoxSports.com. Thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
The careers of Ken Griffey Sr. and Jr. overlapped in Major League Baseball. Richard Petty found himself in the same starting lineup as his son Kyle in NASCAR races. Gordie Howe spent some quality ice time with his sons Mark and Marty, but never has a daughter competed professionally against her father in the highest level of a sport. Only a Game's Greg Eklund has more on the father-daughter duo who've become known this season as the forces of National Hot Rod Association drag racing.
Amid the din of 7,000 horsepower funny car engines idling in the pit area, 14-time world champion John Force of Yorba Linda, California, held an autograph and photo session with one of his sponsors last weekend at the Route 66 Nationals in Joliet, Illinois. His stature in drag racing can best be summed up by the awe Mike Weshkowiak, whose company co-sponsors Force's car, felt after meeting him for the first time.
I would compare this to meeting Michael Jordan, Dale Earnhardt Sr. This is as good as it gets, man. Everybody here has been excited for a year. We've been talking about this since last year.
Sign the back of my shirt, please. Huh?
25-year-old Ashley Force, one of John Force's four daughters, is arguably drag racing's biggest new star. The Force family has been popularized by a TV reality series, Driving Force, aired on the A&E cable channel. Ashley is in just her second year in the NHRA funny car circuit. Last April, at the Southern Nationals in Atlanta, she earned her first win by beating her dad in the final.
It's fun to race him, and to be able to beat him, you know, he's a tough competitor. He's won a lot of championships, a lot of races. But he's also taught us, so we've had the best teacher out here to learn from.
Despite having the best teacher in-house, Ashley Force attended the Frank Hawley Drag Racing School in California. There, she caught what she calls the bug, but Ashley Force says she always felt a competitive drive.
That becomes a part of your life from a young age. I understood about rounds and races and points and championships, so it has been a part of my nature, especially the racing side of it.
When Ashley decided she wanted to race funny cars, John Force, who has more than 1,000 round wins to his credit, remembers his reaction.
Well, I remember it was mixed emotion, and I was always fearful for her, especially for a girl. I also felt that now here this daughter of mine, this little tiny girl, wanted to drive a fuel funny car, wanted to go drag racing someday. That was her dream. So, yeah, I liked it.
But with that dream comes having to deal with what John Force calls the monster, the price drivers pay when something goes wrong at 300 miles an hour. Until last year, neither John Force nor anyone else on his race team had ever been seriously hurt. But 33-year-old Eric Medlin, whom Force called the son he never had, died in March of 07 after a crash at Gainesville Raceway in Florida. Ashley's crew chief, Dean Antonelli, thought she might have second thoughts about competing on the NHRA's funny car circuit.
I had asked her, I said, you know, I'd understand if you didn't want to drive one of these things. You know, you shouldn't want to do this to make your dad happy or worry about, you know, me or Ron or the crew guys. I said, you need to do this because you want to do it. And she immediately said, no, I want to do this because I want to do it. And Eric would be mad at me if I didn't want to do it.
Last September, John Force was seriously injured in a crash at Texas Motorplex. His injuries are still evident. Force, now 59 years old, walks with a pronounced limp. He suffered a broken left ankle, a broken left wrist, and a severe abrasion to his right knee. But Ashley was able to prepare herself for that.
I remember being really young and, you know, seeing crashes and fires. I mean, he had one year in particular where he was on fire every run. And it almost became where we were used to it. I mean, he always walked away from it. He always was doing an interview after the crash, and it was never such a big deal. So it really wasn't until I got older and started racing that I really realized it's not just playtime, and it is a serious sport, and things can happen.
Even when all goes according to plan, a funny car race can take its toll on drivers. But John Force has no doubt his daughter is capable of meeting the physical and mental demands of the sport. To keep herself in shape, Ashley Force lifts weights and kickboxes. But it's her calm nature that leaves him convinced Ashley can become a world champion. He believes Ashley inherited it from his wife, Lori.
To her, it's a beautiful day and the sun is shining. The lawn is green and birds are chirping. That's my wife. And Ashley has a lot of that. And I really believe, even though I have 14 championships and more wins than anybody, I believe that calmness is going to make Ashley a better driver. And if she can learn how to race and win and do it, you know, the way the driving instructors say, calm and cool, it'll make her a better driver.
John Force didn't lose it 2 weeks ago when he won the Summer Nationals in Topeka, Kansas, his first event win since his crash last September. It was also the first time in NHRA history that a father and daughter won events in the same season. In the current Funny Car Point standings, Ashley Force is second, trailing the leader, Tim Wilkerson of Springfield, Illinois, by 57 points. John Force is fourth. The way the season is shaping up, it appears it won't be the last time John Force takes a backseat to his daughter. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Joliet, Illinois.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Yo, you move that pawn, you risk your knight. I could take your bishop, it would serve you right. Take your hand off the queen sucker, that's a move, and you can't take it back, because I'm in a groove, or something like that. The rap group Wu-Tang Clan has set up a new website to promote online chess. Lucky fans may earn the right to play against members of Wu-Tang Clan and other hip-hop stars who dabble in the game. So join in, sucker, and try not to choke. No, it ain't deadly, but it ain't no joke. Some of the profits from the website will be donated to the Hip Hop Chess Federation, which was established to promote analytical thought, unity, and nonviolence.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Jennifer Say, author of Chalked Up, Inside Elite Gymnastics, Merciless Coaching, Overzealous Parents, Eating Disorders, and Elusive Olympic Dreams. But first, the trials that will determine which U.S. gymnasts will go to Beijing begin on Thursday in Philadelphia. Here to preview that event is John Powers, who covers all matters Olympic for the Boston Globe. John, welcome back to Only
a Game. Thanks, Bill.
The first name uttered in discussions of this year's U.S. women's gymnastics team is usually that of Shawn Johnson. Why is that?
Well, she was the girl who went from junior champion to senior champion in 1 year and from senior U.S. champion to world champion in 3 weeks. So she is the girl, uppercase T, uppercase G. However, Nastia Liukin is very, very close to her. This is probably the best 1-2 punch the U.S. has ever had in women's gymnastics coming into the Olympic year.
What particular qualities does Nastia Liukin bring to the competition?
She is grace. She looks lovely on beam, on uneven bars, length of line, very, very classic. Her father competed for the Soviet Union, so it's that old style.
Tell me a little bit about the trials format. What will really be decided in Philadelphia?
Well, for both the men and the women, the top two people in the all-around are automatically on the Olympic team. The men, using a special computerized program, will figure out the next day who the other four should be. You're looking for specialists in various events. The women will go, they'll take everybody else down to the feared Houston boot camp, where Marta Karoly will basically, behind closed doors, look at them all. And that will be not for a month later. So you'll have a lengthy, sweaty limbo for the women.
A lengthy, sweaty limbo. And who else will be involved in the sweating and in the limbo?
One of the key people, actually, in one of the more interesting stories, is Alicia Sacramone. She is a Brown sophomore, kind of in waiting, who was the only, certainly, college student on this team. She is one of the great specialists, a great floor, great vault, and she's the kind of person that you're looking for to fill out a team.
I don't know if she'll make the team, but I'm rooting hard for Darling Hill because I want the opportunity to say Darling Hill many times throughout August. Have I got any shot at that?
There is a reasonable shot. Darling is great on floor, as they say, but I think on this team, you really need to be good in more than one. She is wonderful to watch and even better to pronounce.
Though the other five spots won't be determined until later, many consider the U.S. team to be the favorite going in. Why is that, and what has allowed this year's U.S. team to jump ahead of the traditional elite programs in gymnastics around the world?
Well, the U.S. women basically have been kind of on the rise since the year 2000. One thing that they do now is they have the girls compete for their home clubs and then fly them to Houston for a special boot camp. So they get the best of both worlds. They are the world champions coming in. They won the world title for the first time outside of the U.S. last year, in addition to the all-around title. Shawn Johnson is also the world champion. They are, however, going to a very tough situation. It's rare that you have to compete in the games against the host team, who is also very good. China is quite, quite good.
You mentioned men a few minutes ago, and I had heard the rumor that there will be men competing in this sport in Beijing. Can you
Amazing.
Confirm that for me?
We can. As a matter of fact, the U.S. males, as we say, they were perilously close to missing qualifying for the Olympics 2 years ago, came back, had a wonderful World Championships last year, now ranked fourth in the world. And unlike last year, Paul Hamm, the Olympic gold medalist from Athens, is back in the mix. He broke a bone in his hand, so he'll probably miss the trials, but he'll probably get put directly on the team just based on his resume.
And who else can we look forward to being dazzled by among the men?
His brother Morgan Hamm, who most people can now maybe tell apart. They're basically online. There are 10 different ways to tell the Hamm twins apart.
Tiny birthmark somewhere, that
right.
sort of thing.
That's right. One of them's nose is straighter, I think. Jonathan Horton was fourth in the world last year. It's a very deep men's team. You've got probably 15 of the 15 people at trials, 14 have been on a world or an Olympic team in the past. It'll be very tough to pick the guys for this team.
John, you've been covering the Olympics for many years now, and of course you have by no means limited yourself to coverage of gymnasts. What other athletes or teams from the U.S. or from anywhere else have captured your attention as we get to the two-month point waiting for these games to start?
Well, the big question this year is Michael Phelps. How many countries will he beat all by himself? Michael can win 8 gold medals, which he could have won last time and came very close. As a matter of fact, if Michael really wanted to push himself hard, not that he doesn't, he could swim 11 events at the Olympic Games. But I think he'll limit himself to a menu of 8.
Do you have a sense of how ready for the Olympics Beijing is at this point? That's always been a question, every 4 years when this comes up.
Well, I think it was funny. Last time the joke was, who'll be more ready, Beijing in 2004 or Athens in 2004?
we think it was Athens. They did pull
That's
it
right.
off.
They did so. Pull it off. They have been more than ready for a while. As a matter of fact, the IOC actually told them, slow down a bit here. Their issues mostly are going to be the heat, humidity, pollution, everything that we've been hearing about. I think the pollution won't be as bad as it normally is, but it's still going to be 95 degrees and 90% humidity most days. As we say, it's Houston with noodles. It's going to be difficult on anybody in a long bike race. I wouldn't want to be playing tennis out there for 2 or 3 hours. Most of the athletes won't be affected, certainly those indoors, obviously, and those who are going to be in the shorter events. But it'll be a marathon, even for people not in the marathon.
You've gone to enough of these Olympic spectacles to be comfortable, perhaps, with how difficult the whole thing is and how you're often asked to do a lot of things at the same time. But is it further complicated when there are restrictions on you because of the nature of the authorities in the country where the games are transpiring?
Well, I think so. As a matter of fact, we were guaranteed full access any place we wanted to go. Tibet, they'd be happy to take us out there. Now we're starting to hear, well, there may be some security issues. You may not be able to broadcast from here or there. So I think there's more apprehension now. For most of us, we'll be going back and forth to venues. It won't be an issue. But if you want to go out to Tibet, if you want to go out to Chengdu, it may be more of an issue.
John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe, and he's been our go-to guy of the rings since 1994. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Remembering herself as she was 2 years before she became a national champion, former gymnast Jennifer Say writes, "I would pine for just a nod, a wink of validation, and I'd be willing to do almost anything to get it." Say's new book, Chalked Up, is subtitled Inside Elite Gymnastics, Merciless Coaching, Overzealous Parents, Eating Disorders, and Elusive Olympic Dreams. Jennifer Say joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You write that initially your parents signed you up for gymnastics, quote, hoping I'd have a little fun, get some exercise, and get out of the house for a few hours. That all sounds healthy. How old were you when gymnastics became something other than fun and exercise?
It escalated fairly quickly into a very competitive outlet for me, but it was still fun. I mean, I'm a competitive person. I was then and I am now. So that didn't really take the fun out of it. But I would say by the time I was 8 years old, and I started when I was 6, but by the time I was 8, I was competing. So it was already fairly serious. I still had a great time doing it. And I would say, and I think this is pretty obvious in the book, that it doesn't become a true sort of Herculean battle that isn't fun at all or rewarding at all until the very end of my career.
When you say it started to get serious when you were 8, quantify that for me. How much time per week does a competitive 8 or 9-year-old spend in the gym?
Well, by the time I was 8, I was working out 3 or 4 days a week, depending on whether or not I had a competition coming up, for about 3 or 4 hours a day, which is a lot. You know, I was on the local club team, so every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday after school, I was there from after school until dinner time. And, you know, I have a 7-year-old, and I can't really imagine him doing anything for that stretch of time. and as a parent, I can't really imagine carting him around quite that much at this point in his life, but that's what we did.
A great deal of what's in the book is pretty negative. You write, for example, that you don't remember fourth grade, but you do remember preparing for the state gymnastics championships. Do you feel that somebody, one of your parents, a teacher, maybe a former coach who had dropped out of the gymnastics world, should have suggested different priorities at that point?
Well, I think the thing is, and I've talked to my parents at great length since then, and I even actually recently ran into a teacher of mine from fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and they did all talk about it, but the fact was I performed in school. I had friends. They were largely in the gym and not at school. My best friends were in the gym because that's where I spent a lot of my time. And I think if they had seen my grades dropping or if they had seen evidence that I wasn't a happy child, they probably would have switched things up a little bit for me. But none of that was true.
How old were you when you first started worrying about how much you weighed?
That came later for me. It wasn't until I went to a national training center in Pennsylvania. I was already competing at the elite level, which is the highest level in women's gymnastics, the level which qualifies you for the national team, world championships, things like that. But I had been in a gym between the ages of 10 and 14 that really didn't emphasize that. And, you know, the fact is we worked out 5, 6, 7 hours a day. I mean, we weren't fat, and I didn't really think about it very much. But when I switched gyms and went to this national training center, there was an incredible amount of emphasis placed on weight, and we were weighed in many times a week, oftentimes before and after practice. And it was at that point that I got a little, a lot compulsive about it. And I think it was sort of a perfect storm because it was also the point at which my body was likely fighting to mature, and I was kind of beating that back with a stick.
Well, you had your dad was a doctor when you were growing up, and actually a parent of one of the other gymnasts came to him and said, hey, how do I stop my child from getting her period because her body's going to change? I don't want that to happen.
Yeah, it's true. And my dad, in his typical sarcastic way, told her to get her pregnant, which, you know, I think sent the message that what he was asking was ridiculous. And at that point in time, you know, I had no struggles with eating or with my body. I was quite young. I was about 12 years old, I think, more or less, when my dad relayed that story to me. But it was definitely, you know, that time in gymnastics in the 1980s, the aesthetic, the accepted body type was very, very lean. And I think a lot of the girls really struggled to maintain that body type. You know, when you're 17, 18 years old, it isn't normal to have 2 or 3% body fat. And the tactics that you employ to get there aren't very healthy.
Tell me about some of those tactics.
Well, I mean, the first thing you do is just restrict your eating. But after a while, that stops working. And when I say restrict your eating, I mean, my sort of bar was no more than 500 calories a day. And I remember recording every single calorie in a diary, and I actually found some of those diaries when I was writing the book. You know, I'd write 1 calorie for a Diet Coke, 10 calories for a piece of chewing gum. So I really, really watched every single calorie, which seems so absurd to me now. But after a while, you know, that wasn't enough. And I employed other tactics like compulsive exercise outside of the gym. You know, obviously we were exercising a lot there. But on Sundays when we didn't have practice, I would put on a sweatsuit that made you sweat a whole lot and you know, aerobicize to Jane Fonda for hours on end. I used to spit in a cup to get rid of water weight. That was something I learned from the wrestlers in my high school. They all did that to make weigh-in. And towards the end of my career, I abused laxatives. So, you know, I was sort of in that binge-purge cycle, although I never really binged. A binge was a bowl of ice cream maybe on Saturday night.
You were the national champion in 1986, but there doesn't seem to be much in Chalked Up about celebrating. In fact, less than a year after winning that championship, you describe yourself as heavy with the weight of aging, failure, and being left behind. And you write that you thought about driving into oncoming traffic rather than going to the gym. What happened?
To understand what it took for me to win the 86 Nationals, you have to sort of start with the fact that less than a year before, I'd broken my femur at the World Championships. And the femur is the biggest bone in the human body. I broke my thigh bone. The amount of effort, both physical, emotional, that it took to overcome that, you know, everybody thought I would be done in this sport. They really thought it would be all over for me. I did this horrible thing on this very public stage. And I came back to win about 9 months later. And, you know, in hindsight, I think it just took everything out of me. I don't think I had much left after that. And I remember thinking on the very night that I won, it's going to get worse from here. It's just going to go downhill. And I'd never been at the top before. And it wasn't a position, you know, while I celebrated the moment, it was not a position I particularly savored being in because there's only down from there.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Say, the author of Chalked Up. You're listening to Only a Game. Tell me a little bit about how hard it was to stop competing.
Well, it was incredibly difficult. While I wanted out more than anything towards the end of my career, I was depressed. I'd lost complete touch with the sport. I couldn't even do simple skills that I'd been able to do since I was 8 years old. I was also terrified to leave. I didn't know myself without the sport. I felt not very special without the sport. Many girls stay involved in it as adults because I think it's hard to leave, you know? It's all you know. And you feel good when you're doing it, and you think you can get that back. But once I walked away, because I wanted to find that kind of passion in something else as an adult.
Do you feel that the best gymnasts today are still going through some of the negative things that you went through?
I don't really follow the sport. You know, it's hard for me to believe that they're not experiencing many of the same things. They're little girls in an incredibly intense environment, surrounded by adults who want something from them. That being said, I wouldn't make any assumptions. It's hard for me to believe. I hope it's different. I think at the highest levels, like I said, in anything, there's just an intensity that can sometimes turn on a child.
Jennifer, do you have any sense of how the gymnastics community, the people whom you once strived to please, feel about this book?
You know, they dispute the depiction. And, you know, I understand there'd be a certain degree of defensiveness. They also say that they've changed many of the practices that I speak about in terms of weigh-ins, et cetera. There were some fairly horrific things that happened in the late 80s and early 90s. One fairly prominent gymnast died of anorexia after having been told, you know, the story goes, by a judge that she was too heavy to succeed in the sport. And that brought some attention to the issue within the sport. And I think the federation and the coaches changed their ways in many regards. I would argue if there's even a scale in the gym, there's too much emphasis on it. None of those girls are fat. But that being said, you know, their position is that they support these girls in achieving their dreams of becoming champions. And I would agree with that. They do. And I just would ask the question, at what cost?
Jennifer Say is the author of Chalked Up, Inside Elite Gymnastics, Merciless Coaching, Overzealous Parents, Eating Disorders, and Elusive Olympic Dreams, published by Morrow. She spoke to me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's not unheard of for a soccer team looking at the possibility of promotion to a higher division to take aside an opponent with nothing to lose and negotiate a result. But the subtlety necessary to proper match fixing was absent when two German sides, Rheinkassel Langl 2 and DJK Loewen 2, met in a match that would decide whether the former club would move up a level. When the dust and derision had cleared, Rheinkassel Langl 2 had prevailed by a score of 54-1. After what must have been the simplest investigation ever conducted into a sporting event, the authorities suspended for 1 year all 11 players who started the game for DJK Loewen 2, perhaps the only team ever to have lost a soccer game by 53 goals. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, frolicking through Frogger for fun and fame, immortality even. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA story that apparently isn't ready to go away yet, thanks to ex-ref Tim Donaghy, is about officiating as long ago as the 2002 playoffs. Do you believe the refs in Game 6 between the Kings and the Lakers in that year, 2002, had instructions to make sure that the Lakers won?
Well, this game has been like an epic underground legend ever since it was played. The 27 free throws the Lakers shot in the fourth quarter to force a Game 7. I mean, this has resonated in kind of the NBA underground ever since then. I think the NBA should get its mind around something right now, and that is, regardless of what you think of Tim Donaghy, If half of what he's saying is true, this is what the astronomers call an extinction-level event for the NBA. If it is actually true that the league shoved the officials in a certain direction in order to achieve a certain outcome, Vince McMahon is the next commissioner of the NBA.
Well, that's well put, but I mean, how do they establish that it's true or that it's not true?
Apparently, as it came out in Friday's paper, the FBI has been talking to NBA officials for the last couple of years, Tim Donaghy aside. They've been asking questions about other referees. If this is endemic corruption, then that's bad, but not real bad. If this is endemic corruption for the purposes of the league achieving a certain outcome, that's the end of the league.
David Stern's response to Donaghy's charges had been limited to attacks on his character until a Thursday press conference in which the commissioner rallied to the defense of the league and its officials. Has the NBA commissioner handled this matter effectively?
No, he's bungled it to a fairly well, which is unlike him. The day after day after day of stonewalling based on the fact that Tim Donaghy is a schlub, which everybody with the brain God gave a ficus understands is the truth, but beside the point, really cost him a lot. And then to have this happening in the middle of a championship series, a high-profile, the biggest showcase championship series they've had in 10 years, where officiating played a remarkable part, at least through games 1 through 3, has been altogether to the worst for the NBA, and David Stern has not handled it well. He didn't really handle it well on Thursday simply because he handled it on Thursday too late.
Charlie, let's get beyond the intrigue for a moment and focus on the Boston Celtics, who hold a 3-1 lead over Los Angeles as we speak. No team has ever overcome that deficit in the NBA Finals. How has this series ranked with other NBA Finals that you've watched?
It's a terrific series. It's not as epical a series as some of the other Celtic-Lakers series has been, but it's a perfect example of one team running into exactly the wrong team to play. The national consensus that the Lakers were going to win this series baffled me from the start because, frankly, they're playing the best team in the NBA. The Celtics are, by any conventional measure, the Celtics have been the best team in the NBA since the first time they threw up the ball last fall. The fact is, the Boston Celtics have 5 people on the floor at any one time who can guard people. In an absolute act of charity, I'm willing to give the Lakers 2. Kobe Bryant and maybe Derek Fisher. The rest of them are hopeless defenders. Paul Gasol could not guard me. Okay, when I saw that, I realized that whenever the Celtics wanted to, they could keep the Lakers scoreless for as long as they had to. And that's what you saw in Game 4.
Phil Jackson, who coaches the Lakers, has presided over 9 championship teams, but is Doc Rivers out-coaching him this time around?
I don't know that any pro coach can be said to be out-coaching another. It matters so much on the players. I do know that Doc Rivers has far more options than everybody thought Phil Jackson had.
Barry Bonds, still unemployed. This might not be so surprising, but for the context of the fact, almost all the players named in the Mitchell Report are unemployed. So, coincidence or conspiracy?
I'm sure it's just an accident that 28 general managers are having exactly the same idea. I think the one most baffling thing about this phenomenon is that the only player in the Mitchell Report of any prominence who's still employed is Eric Gagne, who can't pitch anymore. I think the line was drawn in what I'm sure was not a collusive way by these general managers saying, it's okay if you're mentioned in the Mitchell Report if you come back and stink. If you're mentioned in the Mitchell Report and you come back and good and you're really good, that's a bigger problem.
And just when you thought it was safe to go back to the bull yard, intrepid U.S. Representatives Waxman and Davis say that they want to hear more about the 2005 congressional testimony of Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig and Union Chief Donald Fear, citing concerns that in 2004, the league's drug testing program had been suspended for a large portion of the season and that players had been tipped off before tests. This just can't go on too long, can it?
Well, I, for one, have gone far too long without seeing Bud Selig testify because it's one of the exciting moments of my life. Mm-hmm. Oh, look, Bud's testifying again. Let's get C-SPAN up on every sports bar in America. I don't know. I mean, if all this stuff happens, it's worth looking into, I suppose. Waxman is a bulldog, though. I mean, he gets his teeth into something, doesn't let go. So I suspect a couple of more uncomfortable moments for Bud and Don Fear.
Maurecia Grant, who worked for NASCAR as a technical inspector from early 2005 until late last year, has filed a $225 million lawsuit against the organization. She's charging that she was subjected to 23 incidents of sexual harassment and 34 incidents of racial and gender discrimination. Were you surprised by these charges?
Not at all, and I think NASCAR has better settle with Ms. Grant as quickly as possible because NASCAR does not want the discovery in this case. this is a woman who plainly has a lot of evidence on her side that NASCAR never wants to see the light of day. NASCAR, which is absolutely as protective of its image as any sport alive, has really got a problem on its hands here because, frankly, I believe every word she said.
Zara Phillips, one of Queen Elizabeth's granddaughters, has withdrawn from the Beijing Games because her horse is injured. This is the same horse, Toy Town is the horse's name, that kept her out of the 2004 Athens Games, also because of injury. What? A member of the House of Windsor can't afford a new horse?
She's 223rd in line to the throne or something. Buy a new horse! I mean, don't kill this one. Put this one in the park so children can pay, you know, $5 and ride it, or €2 and ride it. But get another horse and go to the Olympics, Sarah.
And finally, Charlie, the Dallas Cowboys' new $1 billion stadium will include a 9,000-square-foot video display. Is this so ticket holders can play Madden NFL 08 during halftime?
I think it's so ticket holders can stay in their house, open the window, and watch the game. Although it's very nice to know that if there are any Cowboy fans among America's shuttle astronauts, they can watch the game once every pass over Dallas.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
19 years ago, I was invited to be part of a panel in Albany, New York, that would be discussing writing concerned with baseball. There was, as I recall, no money involved, and the trip required two flights on a very small airplane. Three good reasons to politely decline the opportunity. But Elliot Azanoff was to be on the panel. I'd long thought Eight Men Out was a terrific book. I liked the movie, too. I got on the very small plane. I sat next to Elliot on the panel, and we had a great time. He offered acerbic asides to the questions, many of which he found pedantic. His asides were very funny. When we were finished, I asked Elliot how he thought it had gone. He shrugged and said, "They laughed at my jokes. The best ones they hadn't even heard." It's fine, I guess, that Elliot Azanoff, who died on Tuesday at the age of 88, was known primarily for writing Eight Men Out, the thorough and thoroughly entertaining account of the Black Sox scandal. He wrote a number of other books, too, some of them set in baseball, all of them dealing in one way or another with prejudice and injustice. Elliot was against both. In the 50s, he was blacklisted by Hollywood. When he obtained his FBI file, he concluded that the blacklisting had occurred because one day in the Bronx, he had signed a petition urging the Yankees to hire black ball players. He was justifiably proud of much of his work. He was proud of having built with his son the house in which he lived. He was probably also proud of shooting his age on the golf course when he was 79, although I never heard him brag about it. In 1994, Elliot collaborated with former pitcher Jim Boughton on a novel called Strike Zone. I interviewed them about the book, and Elliot called me later to tell me that as they had left the building, Boughton had said to him, "I don't think he liked it." Elliot had turned to Boughton and said, "That's because it isn't any good." Shortly before he died, Elliot Azanoff finished work on a novel called Final Judgment, which will be published in the fall. It's set on a college campus, and it concerns a protest to keep President Bush from delivering the commencement address. I look forward to reading it. I'd be looking forward to reading it even more enthusiastically if, after I had finished it, I could call the author and tell him what I thought. So you say you're a video game hotshot and that you've won online tournaments featuring the latest high-tech games, but how do you think you'd do on the old arcade games? Frogger, The Legend of Zelda, Pac-Man, and the always challenging Ms. Pac-Man. Those, among others, were featured earlier this month at the 10th Annual International Classic Video Game and Pinball Tournament. New Hampshire Public Radio's Avishai Artsy was there, and he has this report.
The American Classic Arcade Museum takes up the entire top floor of Fun Spot, a family amusement center in the summer resort town of Weirs Beach, New Hampshire. The museum is crammed with the games of the late 70s and early 80s, like Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, and Mario Brothers. At the 10th annual tournament here, competitors hunch over the coin-operated games, rapidly jerking their joysticks and tapping their fire buttons as they try to gain their spot in arcade history.
When we come here, we don't play just for fun. It's almost like a job. You know, we come here to conquer the game better than anybody else in the entire world if we can.
Rudy Ferretti lives in Las Vegas, where he's been playing competitively on console games for 8 years. He holds 150 world records for various sports games and Nintendo's Nightmare on Elm Street.
I'll be honest, I'm a rookie arcade gamer, so coming here has been fun, yet I've been getting my tail kicked quite a bit in some of these games. So, you know, even the best in the world as I am at certain games, you know, there are certain games that I'm just may never be good at. You know, games like Burger Time, Donkey Kong, but that's okay. You know, everybody's got to have their thing, and if we didn't have weaknesses, then we wouldn't be human.
As we're speaking, Jeffrey Lowe, a 25-year-old from Columbus, Ohio, frantically waves a referee over to record his score on Burger Time. It's a Japanese game in which a chef has to put hamburgers together while dodging enemies like Mr. Hot Dog, Mr. Pickle, and Mr. Egg.
I'm on actually the hardest level of Burger Time right now. There are 32 items that you have to gather up right now. I have all six bad guys. And, well, at this point, I'm panicking a little bit. Because they are moving a lot faster than I remember. This is technically going to be... There we go. That's 2 million points right there. Your average person can get maybe... I don't know. 10,000? So, a little bit better than average here. Now, if you'll forgive me, I gotta focus on this, actually.
Even though there are close to 300 games here, some players spend all their time on just a handful. And when the old games stop working, as they often do, museum director Gary Vincent scrambles to repair them.
The newest game we have in here is 21 years old, and all the way up to some that are pushing close to 40 years old. And you're putting them in a competitive environment now. And it's tough on them. They're old. They don't like to go out and run the marathon anymore.
There's a lot more strain on the games this year, as the four-day tournament has drawn nearly 200 competitors, double last year's number. They hail from across the U.S., and some have traveled from Europe.
You might just get further, that's
Richard Cowald is a Londoner who's here with a couple friends. They're huddled around an Atari multiplayer racing game called Super Sprint.
With the English contingent, we've come over to glamorize the achievements of Tony Temple, Missile That's Command there, World Champion. And in many ways, we kind of worship him. But the guys here, they grew up in the golden age of video games, and we come to Fun Spot just to pay homage. And it's a great trip. It's extraordinary.
The Tony Temple to whom Cowald refers is among the pantheon of video game superstars. Some even call themselves electronic athletes and have their own fan sites. Temple's here today, as is Todd Rogers, who claims to hold over 2,000 world records.
I played Journey Escape on the Atari 2600 for 85 hours. I have the Dragster record I've held since December 1st, 1980. And, of course, the arcade level Gorf, which I've held November 24th, 1982.
One person who could give Todd Rogers a run for his money is Billy Mitchell, described as the greatest arcade video game player of all time. He achieved the first ever perfect game on Pac-Man in 1999 here at Fun Spot, and he figured prominently in last year's documentary film, The King of Kong, but he's noticeably absent from the crowd.
Is Billy Mitchell here, do you know? I would have liked to have seen him. I wanted to ask him some things about Pac-Man to help complete my games, get better on Pac-Man.
That's Rick Vinnis. He's a big fan of Billy Mitchell, and he was so excited the night before the tournament that he didn't get any sleep.
Never seen this many classic games at this day and time for 2008, because nobody has them anymore. So for me, it's like a religious thing. It's come here to Arcade Mecca.
As he navigates Tempest, an Atari shoot-em-up game, Rick seems to become almost childlike. He grew up in a small town in Maryland where he says roller skating and arcade games were all there was to do.
It's like an escape from, you know, the boredom and nobody, you know, nothing to do. This is a different, I get here, I'm the commander of a spaceship. You know what I mean? Over here, I'm Luke Skywalker. It's cool. It's an escape for your mind. You kind of disassociate from reality and go into the machine thing. It's wild. Mm-hmm.
Some players, like Rick, are here to recapture lost youth. Others here are on a mission. Isaiah Triforce Johnson wears a Nintendo Power Glove for good luck as he takes on world records one at a time. And yes, he had his middle name legally changed to Triforce, the sacred relic from The Legend of Zelda.
This is called Black Tiger. It's one of those old-school arcade adventure games, and pretty much
There's a world record on it, 1,015,000 plus, and I'm going to shatter it right now.
And shatter it he does with a score of 2.3 million points while setting world records for seven other games, including Contra, Street Fighter, and Double Dragon 2. Overall, at least 40 records are broken, including the highest ever score in Frogger. Those will be commemorated in the Guinness World Records Gamers Edition. But even those who didn't make history this weekend, like Rudy Ferretti, say the experience was worthwhile.
Obviously, as you can see, I'm here, I'm not making any money today, and this makes me very happy to sign autographs for people that come up to me and appreciate who I am as a person. You know, I'm just like everybody else.
You're signing autographs here?
Oh yeah, I was. I signed quite a few today. Not as much as I would have liked to, but that's okay. Not everybody knows who I am, you know? I'm not Todd Rogers yet. I'm Rudy Ferretti.
And perhaps one day the world will know his name, even if it doesn't include a middle name like Qbert or Super Mario. For Only a Game, I'm Avishai Artsy in Weirs Beach, New Hampshire.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle, Doug Prabhu, and from Jim Bennett at KQED in San Francisco and Mary Gaffney at WBEZ in Chicago. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our video game photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is a Father's Day message from NHRA funny car driver John Force, father of NHRA funny car driver Ashley Force.
So let's stick together. Let's be a family. Give him a big kiss for me and tell him that you love him.
Aw, what can I add to that? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.